Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Last Friday, we were blessed to have Rob Corzine from the St. Paul Center join us to talk about the Bread of Life Discourse. We are continuing that conversation because the discourse continues into this Sunday as well. The Church, in her wisdom, unites especially the first reading with the gospel narrative, but there is a lot of interpenetrating realities and core themes between all the readings, and we're going to try to draw all of that out together, because this is not only a good exercise for the sake of our souls, it also deepens our experience of the Holy Liturgy of the Mass every Sunday. This is something I'd encourage all of you as you listen to, engage this exercise in your own home. I write these gospel reflections on marcusbpeter.com. I encourage you to look at that website. But over and above that, as you continue to do these things, talk about them with your family. Engage the readings with your family at some time during the week, even if it is Saturday. Sit down with your children and your bride or your parents and break open the readings of the coming Sunday. Ask yourselves in prayer what themes are coming out and try to savor them, try to chew on these readings. So this week, we're talking about the Bread of Life Discourse. Rob Corzine is going to join us, and we're going to try to go a little deeper into these readings. After that, we are going to talk about something really heartening. Joshua Wren joins us to take a look at what Pope Francis said in a new letter that he wrote. He wrote a letter on the importance of literature. It's a beautiful piece of work. It truly is. He exhorts us, as only a father would, to come to a deeper appreciation of reading good literature. In fact, the kind of rhetoric he employs is akin to what I've read before from Cardinal St. John Henry Newman in terms of the role of literature in forming the moral imagination, the Catholic imagination at large, and a Catholic worldview. That you can engage all those themes in virtue, in good literature, and still be able to see that Christ is Lord, even if the work doesn't explicitly talk about Jesus Christ. So we're going to quote from that letter of Pope Francis, and we're also going to explore what kinds of literature you and I might be able to start engaging with our families. All of this and more. For now, let's take a look at the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, August 9th. It's the Feast of St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Austrian officials are giving more details about the foiled terror plot that they say targeted three Taylor Swift concerts in the country. NBC's Keir Simmons reporting what police are saying about the 19-year-old suspect.
The 19-year-old had recently quit his job, saying he had consumed large amounts of ISIS and Al-Qaeda propaganda.
Officials say the 19-year-old confessed in planning to kill himself and a large number of people using explosive devices and knives. California Governor Gavin Newsom wants cities and countries to step up removing homeless encampments and says he'll withhold funds from those who don't. Thursday, he was personally out with crews in Mission Hills clearing an encampment.
Wildfires in Northern California, there's 6,500 people right now on the park fire. I want to see that kind of urgency on the issue of encampments. It's not complicated.
The governor signed an executive order last month giving local governments the authority to get rid of the encampments and ticket homeless people for camping in public. Donald Trump believes abortion will only be a small issue in the general election. During a news conference from Mar-a-Lago, Trump defended the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, arguing states now have the choice to make their own abortion laws. Trump reiterating his support for exceptions for abortion bans in cases of rape, incest, or the life of the mother. Meanwhile, Kamala Harris is putting abortion rights front and center of her campaign. And a former senior advisor to President Biden says he suspended his reelection campaign because of horrible attacks by the media and high-profile Democrats. In an interview with Politico, Anita Dunn said Biden's poor debate performance against Donald Trump wasn't the reason for his campaign's demise. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Last Sunday, we saw Jesus begin to deliver his famous Bread of Life discourse. The teachings will continue for the next few weeks as we work our way through the sixth chapter of John's Gospel. Joining me to talk about these readings, as he does every week, is Rob Corzine, a friend, and he's the Vice President of Academic Programs for the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Rob, it is great to speak with you again. How do you do?
I'm doing wonderfully well. It's always great to be with you.
You know, I must express slight disappointment that when I was at Steubenville at the Applied Biblical Studies Conference, I did not get to run into you. I hope to be able to see you the next time I'm down there.
We should make sure that happens.
So, the Bread of Life discourse, before we start diving into the readings, I just want to ask you, because you're a fellow convert, my church conveniently skipped over exegeting on the Bread of Life discourse. My Protestant church, we talked about it, we read it, we prayed over it, and then that was it. We never exegeted on it, and for obvious reasons. And I remember studying it and realizing that this stuck out like a sore thumb, and I understood how it was incompatible with the Pentecostal faith I was professing. Was that the same experience for you?
It was, and it's kind of a common feature of Protestant churches is that they're pastor-led, and so you end up focusing in the homilies and the sermons on passages the pastor is comfortable with and familiar with, and it's a real blessing of the lectionary that the church sets before us so much of the scripture, all of the gospels, and we can't avoid the hard questions, we can't avoid the tough passages, and for us as Protestants, this would have been one of those tough passages, because on the face of it, it seems to be saying the Catholics are right about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and we had ways of getting around that, but we didn't spend time focusing on it.
That's right, because it would be scandalous to the population to acknowledge that people were scandalized when Jesus said, no, literally eat my flesh and drink my blood.
Yeah, and I was from a Baptist denomination that was really big on, no, believe the Bible, what it says, literally, until we got to passages like John 6, and we're like, oh no, that's got to be metaphorical.
That's right.
That can't be literally true.
That's right. I was told the exact same thing. So let's get literal about the scriptures. What are we seeing happening in the lineup of the readings this weekend?
Well, I really love, so last week, the Old Testament reading set us up to see the manna in the desert as a type of the Eucharist. This time we have the great prophet Elijah, probably the greatest Old Testament prophet. The books of 1 and 2 Kings really should be called the books of the prophets rather than the books of the kings. And this is a weird episode in Elijah's life. This is just a few verses after his great triumph, where he calls the 450 prophets of Baal to the top of a hill and not only embarrasses them, by having them try and call down fire from heaven, and then he does call down fire from heaven, and then has the people of Israel, you know, turn and kill them all. And so, like, he's triumphed. The Lord has triumphed. His challenge, you know, if Baal is real, serve him. But if the Lord your God is real, serve him. He should be riding on the clouds at this point. This great miracle has kind of vindicated his preaching. But as soon as the word gets to Jezebel, she's like, I'm going to kill him.
That's right.
And he's now running for his life, completely discouraged, barely makes it out of Israel and down into Judah, and lays down and said, Lord, kill me. And the angel of the Lord comes, says, get up and eat. And there's a jug of water and a heart cake. Get up and eat again. There's a jug of water and a heart cake. And those meals last him 40 days and 40 nights of walking down to the mountain of God. So
that's right.
It's a brilliant image of the Eucharist as viaticum, as food for the way.
That's right.
That what you need to get to the mountain of God is this supernatural bread that only God provides.
I'd like to just hone in on one sub theme. This is not a deviation, but I don't want to miss it. This whole God kill me is a recurring theme for some of the prophets. Do the will of the Lord, and things don't work out your way. Well, God take my life. Jonah does the same thing, and
yep.
And the fact is, God doesn't answer by taking their life. He answers them by providing for them even more, which is ostensibly what the Eucharist is for us.
Yeah, like I'm not gonna let you die, but I'm going to take your life and give you mine.
Mm. Yep, exactly. So let's move on from that.
They pray for death. He says, "No, what you get is life."
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to the mountain of the Lord, and this is where we have the, you know, his epiphany, where he hears. Not in the fire, not in the thunder, not in the great wind, but in the still small voice.
Yeah,
the word of the Lord, and so again, also Psalm 34. This is another one of those divine deliverance, and Jesus or the psalmist, in this case David, you know, expresses that taste and see. The goodness of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is background that the church kind of sets us up
right.
to read this next section of the Bread of Life discourse, and again those Exodus themes are there. At the very beginning, we read the Jews murmured about Jesus because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven."
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a quick aside point: John will often refer to the Jews. And he gets a reputation of being anti-Semitic, but it's really, it's a misunderstanding. Judaioi in John almost always means not the followers of Judaism, but the people of Judah.
That's right.
Judaioi means Judean rather than Galilean.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this takes place up in Galilee, that's a reference to the murmuring is a reference to the Exodus, and Jews there don't mean the followers of Judaism. It's all of the people there who are scandalized at this notion that that Jesus says, "I am the bread that came down from heaven," and they're like, "Wait, we know this guy.
That's right.
This is Jesus. His father is Joseph. We know his mother. You know, how can he say I came down from heaven?" And Jesus says again, "Stop murmuring among yourselves," using that Greek word, gagazuto,
mm-hmm.
Which is pulled from the way that the Israelites were treating Moses in the desert. And then he gives us this reference to a famous messianic prophecy of Isaiah. Says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me will draw him. I will raise him on the last day, as it is written by the prophets, that they shall be taught by God." That's a passage, Isaiah 54, that's so famous, we read it as the fourth reading on the Easter Vigil. This
right.
is about God coming, the Father coming to restore his people and draw him back. It's using bridal imagery there.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus is really kind of doubling down.
Yep.
Is like, actually, not only do you not know who my real father is, but this prophecy pertains here when God is going to come and gather his people again. And so this is a really strong claim to his divinity. And again, he doubles down. "Amen, amen, I say to you, whoever believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate the manna in the desert, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven,
yep.
that someone may eat of it and not die." There's one other biblical referent there. There is there's an Old Testament food that you can eat of and not die, the tree of life, back in the Garden of Eden, where Adam was permitted to eat the tree of life, but instead went to the forbidden tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The church fathers pick up on this from John 6, and so often the cross is referred to and depicted in early Christian art as that tree of life, that we eat from it so that a man can eat of it and not die.
That's right. Rob, we're continuing this conversation. Rob Causeen is Vice President of Academic Programs for the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Stay tuned. We're breaking open the Bread of Life discourse, and as we break bread with each other, we hope that you gain from it. I'm Marcus Peter.
Every year, couples who go on the Ave Maria Radio's Good News Cruise testify how their marriages are revitalized and transformed. Join us on the next Good News Cruise from January 5th to 11th on the Royal Caribbean's Oasis of the Seas. You'll be joined by Father Michael Schmitz, Teresa Tamio, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and many more speakers. Cabins are selling fast, so be sure to book your spot now. Faith and fun on the sea and in the sun. There's no topping that. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the travel tab to find out more.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
When I've had enough. I ask parents, when do you decide to discipline? One of the most common answers is, when I've had enough. If discipline is designed to teach, then we need to discipline before we've had enough. We need to discipline because the behavior's wrong, not because emotionally it's pushed us to our edge. Besides, when you get to when you've had enough, you're much more likely to yell and scream and say things that you have to go to confession for. So, the suggestion is discipline out of principle, not emotion. Principle means because it needs discipline, and I'm going to do it when I'm calm. Emotion means I'm going to be moved to do it just because I'm mad.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Rob Causeen, Vice President of Academic Programs for the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Rob, we were talking earlier about the fact that this reading shows us that the Eucharist is the fruit, the new covenant fruit of the new covenant tree of life. And I've always loved that imagery as soon as I discovered it. And there's a real sense of messianic reclamation of all that was lost from the garden onwards. And one of the things I want to point out is in this reading alone, just the small chunk that we take this weekend, Christ packs a lot of messianic symbolism into this, even the short section of the passage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that Isaiah 54 passage, it's worth going back and just start it at verse 5 and read on. It's one of the, I think it's one of the most beautiful passages in that Easter Vigil liturgy of the intimate love that the Father has for his people and the kind of way he wants to unite himself. And Jesus, just by that one line, they shall all be taught by God, invokes that whole context. So that his Father is going to become their bride.
Yeah.
And then even more intimately, right, he is going to make himself our food.
Mm.
And he ends this, the bread that I will give is my flesh for the life of the world. And he's pointing forward to the cross, the new tree of life. And so he's giving his flesh in a twofold sense. First, he gives his physical body to be our sacrifice there on the cross. And then sacramentally, he gives us his body for food.
Right.
And a food unlike the Old Testament bread that comes down from heaven, where you could eat it and still die, but whoever eats this bread will live forever.
Yeah. And just for the sake of our listeners, too, Isaiah 53, 54, 55, leading into 56, those are very deeply messianic portions of the book of Isaiah. And the people Jesus is speaking to knows this. This is about the suffering servant. This is about the coming Messiah. So when he quotes this in reference to himself, he's making a very clear claim here. I'm not only God, I am God made man, and I am the Messiah you've been waiting for, and this is the way I will suffer and die.
Yeah, when God promised to come back and to unite yourselves to him, this is that happening right now, right here.
Yep.
So, and they were expecting a Messiah, but they weren't expecting this kind of Messiah.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of a Messiah were they expecting?
Well, twofold. They expected a priestly Messiah and a kingly Messiah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those streams are so different in some Old Testament passages that the Essenes out at Qumran thought there would be two separate figures.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only way that we see those come together is in Jesus, who is both the kingly and the priestly Messiah. And of course, he's also the fulfillment. He's the perfect prophet. He is the word of God as well. So all of the senses in which Old Testament figures were messiahs, were anointed ones, Jesus unites in a way that we couldn't predict. But looking back, you see how it couldn't be different. That's kind of the mark of true prophecy, that it is fulfilled in detail, but you can only really see it reading backwards.
So let's take a look at how Paul refers to this sacrifice of Christ, that Christ has made himself a sacrificial offering to God for a fragrant aroma. He's making a very specific reference here to a kind of Levitical offering in the temple that were described as fragrant offerings, fragrant aromas that arose to the heavens for God.
Yeah, it's wonderful how the church is just doing a lectio continua with the second reading. We're just sort of reading our way through Ephesians, but when you focus it through the lens of the Old Testament and the Gospel, mm-hmm. it often does this. It has this sort of beautiful way of bringing out something that you might have missed if you were just reading straight through Ephesians 4. I think the whole passage has a lot to do for us with the way that we should prepare ourselves for Mass. We should prepare ourselves for communion by not grieving the Holy Spirit of God with which you were sealed for the day of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And then a list of things, bitterness, fury, anger, shouting, reviling, must be removed from you with all malice. But then down there, as you were referencing, be imitators of God as beloved children and live in love as Christ loved us and handed himself over for us as a sacrificial offering to God for a fragrant aroma. We have this language, the ruach nakuach, the pleasing aroma of the sacrificial liturgy, the incense offered in the temple, in the priestly sections of the Pentateuch. And the Eucharist is that place where we experience Christ as our sacrifice, and that demands of us that we be people of love, people who live in love toward one another. So the Eucharist is not just a gift to us, but also a requirement on us.
Right. And the Bread of Life discourse is not given in a vacuum. By this point, Christ had been in active ministry for a while. They had been hearing his teachings. He's been dropping those bombshells, if you were, of the new covenant law. So this moral expectation of a certain fittingness was required in order to partake of this Eucharistic banquet that Christ is talking about here. So even as these people are listening, they understand that the new Moses gives the new covenant law, and he's promising us a kind of new Passover, a new meal, and a new manna, but that necessitates something from us.
Yeah, and John situates us in time, that we're in the north, we're in Capernaum, but this is the time of the Passover.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus chooses very carefully the time to give this Bread of Life discourse. This is the Passover, and it's the Passover immediately 1 year before his final Passover, where he'll institute the Eucharist in the upper room and then complete that Eucharist on the cross.
There's a certain scandal involved in the minds of the Jews when it comes to Christ saying, it's my flesh and my blood, I am the bread of life. And it would take even the apostles a great leap of faith to finally understand what this means, because the consumption of, first of all, blood, but then secondly, human flesh, these were abhorrent. They would literally cut you off from the covenant community if you did that.
Yeah, I mean, Leviticus 17, drinking mm-hmm. blood cuts you off from the people. Sometimes it is a it's the kind of punisher, the punishment like in Isaiah 49, I will make your oppressors to drink their own blood. Mm. In Revelation 17, we see the woman who rides the beast drunk with the blood of the saints and martyrs. That was for me the big kicker in getting past any kind of a merely metaphorical reading of this. Because if this is merely metaphor, if he's just saying it's like drinking my blood, then that's a negative metaphor.
That's right.
For these people. The background that they have to understand that blood is forbidden. Mm-hmm. We can't even drink the blood of an animal that we're allowed to eat without being cut off. So if it's a metaphor, it's a really, really bad metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And a metaphor of violence and judgment, which is clearly not what he's intending here.
Right.
He's saying, like, this is a thing that not that cuts you off from the people, but a thing that that gives you life.
Mm.
And my inability to find any way where that could be a comforting or a metaphor for intimacy. Was really the kicker for me, and like I can no longer try and I find an angle at which I can squint and see this is not intended to be taken literally. He literally has not left that open to us.
That's right. And we will continue this conversation with Rob next week as we move forward in the Bread of Life discourse. Thank you for making the time. My guest has been Rob Kozin, Vice President of Academic Programs for the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Stay tuned as we talk about the letter of the Holy Father on the role of literature in formation. I'm Marcus Peter.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
What do we mean by intercessory prayer? The Catholic Catechism defines intercessory prayer as asking on behalf of another. It is a prayer attuned to God's mercy. It is a prayer of petition that leads us to pray as Jesus did. Jesus is the one intercessor with the Father on behalf of all mankind, especially sinners, because, says the Catechism, Jesus is able for all time to save the souls who draw near to God through him. Jesus lives to make intercession for such souls. When one prays intercessory prayer, he or she is looking out not just for one's own interest, but for the interest of others, even for one's enemies. The intercession of Christians recognizes no boundaries, says the Catechism. Prayers are extended for all men, for kings or for persecutors, and even for the salvation of those who reject the gospel. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. By asking for spiritual communion, we are acknowledging that the Holy Mass is the perfect, best way to worship God. The priest intercedes perfectly for us with God the Father because he acts in persona Christi. This is the time to see that through the priest's representation of Christ's sacrifice on Calvary, we are never separated from our Lord. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. On the 4th of August this year, Pope Francis released a letter entitled The Letter of the Holy Father and the Role of Literature in Formation. This new letter explains and explores the importance of reading literature and the teaching of literature informing the human person and their conscience and their thinking and imagination. We are joined by Joshua Wren, who takes a look at what Pope Francis said and how you and I can read and write like Catholics. Joshua Wren is a novelist, father, and husband, founder and editor of Wise Blood Books, and co-founder of the Master of Fine Arts and Creative Writing at the University of St. Thomas, Houston. He regularly publishes essays and poems in journals such as the Los Angeles Review of Books and First Things, America and Public Discourse, New Polity, and the Hedgehog Review. Joshua, it is great to speak with you. How are you doing?
Oh, it's a total joy to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. The pleasure is all mine. And I love that you and I share this as a mutual appreciation, that literature is not to be excluded in our theological and philosophical pursuits. The forming of our intellect can be done beautifully, rightly, and holistically when we consume of and think about good literature.
Yes, I mean, this question that Pope Francis is wrestling with in the new letter is very old. It goes all the way back to St. Basil of Caesarea, and he cites St. Basil in the document. And Basil is looking at all of this pagan literature, for example, the epics of Homer, and trying to determine, to discern whether these pagan texts can be absorbed into the Christian tradition and be edifying for people.
Right.
And this raises a big question in terms of the role of literature. Is it supposed to be edifying? And what's fascinating in Pope Francis's letter is that he sort of, on the one hand, says, yes, it is good to have literature where the heroes or heroines are embodying virtue. But we can't reduce literature's goodness just to that. And in fact, he specifically says, it is clear then that the reader is not simply the recipient of an edifying message, but a person challenged to press forward on a shifting terrain where the boundaries between salvation and perdition are not a priori obvious and distinct. Now, I think that when we first hear that, some of us might be startled, right? He says that the boundaries between salvation and perdition are not obvious and distinct, and we want to say, well, wait a minute, those boundaries are very clear.
Yeah.
Revelation has laid down what needs to happen for us to be saved, and what will happen if we depart from that, we'll be heading towards damnation. But he offers an important clarification to that, a couple pages later, when he says, literature is not relativistic,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's not to say that just because in a particular character's story, it's hard initially to discern whether they are saved or damned.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that literature is relativistic. It does not strip us of values, he says. The symbolic representation of good and evil, of truth and falsehood, as realities that in literature take the form of individuals and collective historical events, does not dispense us from moral judgment, but prevents us from blind or superficial condemnation.
Right.
So I think that's a hugely important qualification there. What he's really arguing is that if we're just being formed by, let's say, reading the Catechism,
mm-hmm.
and it's not to discount the significance of the Catechism, but if we're just being formed on a steady diet of the Catechism, we can become habitually inclined to be heavy-handed in our moral judgments. We can be rash and overly moralistic, kind of like the Pharisee who's looking at the publican and saying, thank you, Lord, for not making me like that other person. We look at other people, we look at characters in films or in books, and we sort of have this inclination to judge them quickly. We read as if and only to show that we are morally superior than the characters that we're reading about who are full of failures and foibles. So Pope Francis is basically saying that instead, literature should sensitize us to this capacity for discernment, right?
Mm-hmm.
For looking at mitigating circumstances that surround any human life.
Right. So he's acknowledging the reality that there are conditions that diminish moral culpability, which the Catechism itself highlights. I gently disagree, because I actually believe that a prayerful reading of the Catechism does in fact form the moral imagination well. But I also want to say I agree with you in this. As we're talking about this, and as I read this letter before, what came to mind was the figure of Frodo in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Many people, I belong to a lot of groups, and once in a while people take a stab at Frodo for falling at the end, failing at the end. He wasn't able to relinquish the ring, but that was an extremely valuable thing that Tolkien did. He wanted to illustrate that the fallen nature is incapable of moral absolutes, and that's the life that we live.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, Frodo at the end is wounded, and that is an analogy basically of Christ,
mm-hmm.
who, when he is resurrected, still has the wounds in his hands,
right?
It's not as if when he passes through the Passion and then comes back, the wounds are gone. They're
mm-hmm.
not eliminated, right? It's part of his eternal state that they remain with him. And so it's this beautiful articulation of both redemptive suffering and the mercy of God.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to just return. I love what you said about the reading of well-formed reading of the Catechism can develop and stimulate the moral imagination. And I absolutely agree with that. I think that what Pope Francis is getting at in this letter is that for many people, they need to have their moral imaginations formed in part by literature
mm-hmm,
as well
mm-hmm.
as the Catechism. So I just want to clarify that I don't mean to dismiss it. And in this regard, he sounds similar to St. John Henry Newman.
Right, right.
Who,
the idea of a university.
Idea of literature, yeah, in his idea of a university and the discourse on literature, he raises this question. Well, you know, theology is so good, so unqualifiedly and undiluted good, and philosophy so unqualifiedly and so undiluted good, why do we even need to teach literature at all? Why
mm-hmm.
shouldn't we just eliminate it from our classrooms? And this is what he says in response to that question. We cannot possibly keep them, that is to say our students, from plunging into the world with all its ways and principles and maxims when their time comes. But we can prepare them against what is inevitable. And it is not the way to learn to swim in troubled waters never to have gone into them.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminate from your classroom, cut out from your books all broad manifestations of the natural man and his rebellion, and those manifestations are waiting for your pupils' benefit at the very doors of your lecture room in living and breathing substance. So I think that, right, it could be one way to clarify this is that it could be actually perilous to just be formed in your ethical and moral sense by reading literature without consulting the Catechism or without reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and really coming equipped and sort of well steeped in an ethical tradition, let's say like Thomistic virtue ethics. And if you're just reading literature, I mean, there are a lot of even great books that contain tremendous amounts of ambiguity.
Right.
And you could be left, you know, I appreciate Newman's point that it's not the way to teach someone to swim, never to let them go into troubled waters. But some literary waters are so troubled that the reader should not really enter into them without some sort of a priori formation vis-a-vis the catechism, vis-a-vis the liturgy, right, and the sacraments.
That's right.
Which can strengthen someone to be able to, as Newman would put it, make these kind of discriminations, separate the precious from the vile.
That's right. We are continuing this conversation with Joshua Hren, novelist, father and husband, and prolific author in numerous journals. We are talking about forming the moral imagination by means of reading literature alongside the readings of Truths of the Faith. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Even if you don't know what you're supposed to be doing, if you're saying yes to God, if you're following God and saying, okay, I know you want to take me to a certain place, I'm not under sure where it is, but I'm just going to keep walking in faith. So in other words, as the gospel says, you don't hide your light under a bushel, even if you're not sure what that light is exactly supposed to look like. Even if it means you're just getting out of the house and volunteering for something, do something with your talents. Be a light to somebody somewhere. And God sees you taking a step toward Him, even if you're not sure where that step is going, that He's going to move toward you. And gradually, you're going to see how your light is going to be used. And I'm going to be a gift, be a light, be salt for someone.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Make family life the most important activity on your calendar. Parents often worry about losing their kids' hearts to peers, to the culture, or to the media. But simply restricting your kids' access to friends, culture, or media isn't the answer. Spending more time with them is. Kids give their hearts to the people and things they spend the most time with. If we're not making daily family time the most important activity on our schedule, we're effectively giving our kids permission to give their hearts to someone other than us. Putting family time first and scheduling other activities around it is one of the most important practices Catholic families can have. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We are talking about Pope Francis's recent letter exhorting us, the faithful, to engage in reading literature for the sake of forming our consciences, our intellects, in living rightly. And my guest is Joshua Wren, novelist, father and husband, and prolific author who's published in numerous journals. So, Joshua, we were talking earlier about how there's a real necessity for our minds, our intellects to be formed rightly in catechesis, in the system of morality, of theology, so that when we read literary works, we know how to discern carefully what is the moral good to be taken from it.
Yes, very much so. And then the flip side of that is connected to it, and they both are necessary to be held together. Pope Francis says, midway through the document, he cites T.S. Eliot, and Eliot, who is one of the great modern Christian poets, says that there seems to be in our day a kind of widespread emotional incapacity. Mm. So this raises this question of, in part, Pope Francis says, maybe the problem for faith today is not primarily that of believing more or believing less with regard to particular doctrines, but rather the inability to be profoundly moved in the face of God. Now, I would again say that the problem in our time is both. There's both a lot of doctrinal confusion, but there's also a problem with a sort of lack of a sentimental education. And I think that C.S. Lewis, you know, who's a contemporary of T.S. Eliot, was getting at something similar in The Abolition of Man when he said that what we really need for education is not just sort of knowing rationally what is right and wrong, but being able to love what ought to be loved and to hate what ought to be hated, right? So our passions need to be educated, and it's really the place of literature in particular, with its density and its appeal to our affections, that is able to persuade on that kind of level in a very unique and beautiful way.
Right. And even then, right, the passions need to be quote-unquote educated. And by that, really what Pope Francis is getting at is the intellect needs to be formed well, that it may govern the will and the passions, so that we know how to evoke them rightly when it comes to encountering these things. Because if not, we allow our passions to be swayed by every whim of doctrine, including, for example, reading a book wherein good and evil don't exist, they're moral neutrals. And and all of a sudden, the axiom here is the pursuit of power and nothing else. And you and I both know literary works that lean toward that.
Yes, very much so. And this is actually why I think that there's a little bit of a tension in this document that I'd like to just discuss and draw out. And I think it's ultimately resolved, but it's a good kind of stimulation for conversation. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the letter, Pope Francis says that readers in some sense rewrite a text, enlarging its scope through their imagination, creating a whole world by bringing it into play, their skills, their memory, their dreams, and their personal history with all of its drama and symbolism. Now, later on, he says something that's very different, almost the opposite of that, which is reading is an act of discernment. Readers are not only the subjects, but they're also the objects of what is being read. He says, in reading a novel or a work of poetry, the reader actually experiences being read by the words that he or she is reading, right? So in the first instance, he's coming quite close to a school of literary criticism that's oftentimes known as reader response, which is sort of that the reader sits down with a text and really reinvents it, rewrites it according to his own feelings, his own taste, his own opinions, and kind of imposes those tastes and opinions on the book.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, of course, there's something really true that when you sit down with a work of literature, unlike, let's say, going to see a dramatic play or watching a movie, your imagination definitively is invited and engaged.
Yep.
In a much more profound way. You are envisioning what these different scenes or characters look like, smell like, right, along with the author.
Right.
But there's also a risk there, which is...
If I may interject really quickly. To illustrate for our listeners, this is why people who read the book and then watch the movie can't stand the movie, because the imagination have been stimulated that way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I never knew that Mr. Darcy looked like that, you know, all these years. I didn't know that he was Colin Firth, you know, but yeah, exactly. So I deal with this with students all the time in introductory literature courses, mm-hmm. where they're just sort of like, you know, imposing their wayward feelings on a book, and it just sort of, they're not really letting the book change them. They want to just rule and dominate over it. And I think in the second quote that Pope Francis is getting at, you know, readers can be compared to players on a field. They play the game, but the game is also played through them, in the sense that they are totally caught up in the action.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a kind of a corrective to that problem of reader response, that you are allowing the text, the book, to really sweep you away, you know, and this is what I think he's getting at when he cites Marcel Proust in this really beautiful passage where he says, you know, what's amazing about novels is that they, in the space of an hour, they unleash in us all the possible joys and misfortunes that in life it would take us entire years to know,
yeah.
even slightly, and of which the most intense would never be revealed to us because the slowness with which they occur prevents us from mm-hmm. perceiving them. So again, I think our best writers, novelists and poets, are able to distill a tremendous range and depth of human experience and longing for the divine
yes.
that most of us can't even give voice to, can't even articulate. You know, at the bottom of the Inferno and at the top of the Paradise in Dante's Divine Comedy, he mm-hmm. says, I don't even have words, I don't even have rhymes to describe, to articulate what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. It's so profound. But then T.S. Eliot has this wonderful line that the poet, the writer, is really trying to achieve a raid on the inarticulate.
Right.
And this is, I think, what Proust is getting at, that for most of us, you know, we go through our lives, we want to be able to make sense of these deep responses or experiences that we have to the real, to the reality around
mm-hmm.
us. But for most of us, we don't have the capacity to articulate them. But if we sit down with a novel, suddenly experiences that we've been trying to sort out for 10 years might suddenly be elucidated or clarified.
That's right. That's right. That's right. This author gets what I'm going through.
Exactly.
In fact, reading this portion of the text, I remember thinking of Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn. Mm-hmm. Immediately thought of those two men for this particular reason. They both have a capacity of articulating the depths of depravity and darkness without losing mm-hmm. the objectivity of divine hope. And that's something that many of us are simply unable to articulate by ourselves.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And Georges Bernanos, the Catholic novelist, has an excellent sort of diagnosis of what's happening in someone like Dostoevsky. And he mm-hmm. says, you know, for novelists who don't have that mystic soul, right, for novelists who are not, right, sort of spiritually attuned, when they try to portray evil, at least one of two or maybe even more things, but let's just stick with two for now, things happen. On the one hand, and I'm paraphrasing Bernanos here, but on the one hand, I'm sort of riffing off of him. On the one hand, you have this problem of beyond writers who are sort of beyond good and evil mm-hmm. that you were talking about earlier, right? They write as if there is no such thing as evil. But then on the other hand, you have people dealing with wrongdoing on just a strictly sort of material or even just natural level, where we're just talking about that person is not, they've done something wrong. They're not really portrayed as evil. They're portrayed as not nice, mm-hmm. you know, or something like that. Or
right.
They're just sort of, they made an error or a mistake. But what Catholic and Christian writers who are great souled, like Dostoevsky or Solzhenitsyn, are able to draw out is the radicality of evil, right? Which is to say that at the deepest, inmost depths, Bernanos says, the soul is in outright rebellion against God, right? And you might say, well, what good could come from encountering a dramatization of that? That sounds horrifying. That sounds terrible. It doesn't sound very optimistic or upbeat. And the immediate response would be, well, yeah, in and of itself, it's not. But in encountering an articulation and a dramatization like that, the effect on the reader is to say, oh, my God, my Lord and my God, now I know why I need to be saved.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Whereas if you just sort of encounter someone where wrongdoing is portrayed as just kind of not being nice, mm-hmm. there's nothing to be saved from, right? Mm-hmm. You're already sort of more or less a good person even when you do bad things, you know?
That's right. That's right. Well, Joshua, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I look forward to future conversations. God bless you, and thank you for making the time to speak with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks be to God.
My guest has been Joshua Wren, novelist, father, and husband. He's the author of How to Read and Write Like a Catholic. It's a enlightening book, and I'd greatly encourage you to pick up a copy of it. I also want to encourage you this weekend, if you have the time, read to your children. Pick up a simple work of literature, gauge where your children are at, or if you are a child, read with your parents. Talk about a particular work of good literature. Pick up Lewis, pick up Chesterton, pick up Tolkien, he's my favorite fictional author. Or pick up Virgil, pick up Homer. Any one of these classical authors that help us engage and stimulate our moral imagination so that the theology that the church hands down to us, the truths of the faith that the church endows upon us as her children, are seen, portrayed, and lived out. Because what we see in these fictional works is this great condensation, if you will, of the human experience. And when we come into contact with that, our catechesis, our philosophy, our theology, our reasoning, they're all engaged. Something within us either recoils or rejoices in the sight of what we are reading. We loathe the depravity of Gollum. We celebrate the virtue of Aragorn. So do that with your family and enjoy this weekend reading good literature as the Holy Father is compelling us to. Until next week, I'm Marcus Peter.